Good. I'd like to ask for your attention. As you probably sensed, that my interest in this weekend is to emphasize to the two what I believe to be lesser known aspects of Brahmavihara practice, namely the acknowledgement that we all have an innate capacity for those Brahmaviharas, however these may be still dormant, and that this innate capacity to be loving, to be resonant in compassion, to be resonant in joy, and to be in relationship while being equanimous and acknowledging responsibility of self and other. And the second level, namely that these Brahmaviharas are something outside of meditation practice as well as just meditative exercises, that these Brahmaviharas are to be found in relationship, that these Brahmaviharas can be easily seen in others' actions, in others' verbal deportment, in others' discerned intentions. And on that second level, these Brahmaviharas, so tell us the commentaries, have enemies. Well, sometimes it helps us to understand the quality better if we look at the inimical force, the hostile force to that quality. So I'd like you to follow me in this little excursion of how the enemies of these Brahmaviharas manifest and look like. The commentarial tradition tells us that there are two enemies for each of the Brahmaviharas. One enemy is the close enemy. And the close enemy is described as somebody who lurks right outside of your house, where you feel still safe, where you still feel this is your place, where you still feel quite confident and where you least expect it. So the close enemy is generally something that has great similarity to the Brahmavihara itself. No? It looks, on one level, just as the quality you like to cultivate. On another level, it turns out to be its opposite or its enemy. The far enemy is the enemy that waits for you at your furthest point of the journey. It's the direct opposite, usually, of the Brahmavihara, and it takes you into the wilderness. It takes you into the over to dark side. The slang would be joining the dark side. So the far enemy is as if the enemy waits for you when you're at the most remote point in your journey, and waits for you in the mountains and in the forest, where you feel the least safe. So what are these enemies? Obviously, we have identified metta as capacity receiving, welcoming, interest, availability, attuning to. And the near enemy of metta is greed. It is the wish to have. It is the wish to appropriate. It is the direct seeking of gratification. So as metta sees the advantage of some person, as metta sees the strengths of something, sees the beauty and the goodness of something, so does greed. Greed sees the goodness of something. Greed is quite capable of acknowledging advantage, beauty, value of something. Greed is quite capable of doing that. It's interesting that Buddhist psychology also acknowledges not just that greed is a danger to, say, loving kindness, but it also acknowledges that there is an intrinsic likeness in greed that also makes it possible to develop wholesome qualities. Yeah. The force of appreciation, for example. So our direct enemy to metta, which seeks the well-being of whoever is in the focus of our metta, greed sees the beauty of that thing or that person, but seeks appropriation, seeks the enjoyment, seeks the owning, seeks the getting it. Yeah. I think that's fairly close, isn't it? And, you know, do not consider the word greed or desire. This sounds rather harsh. Yeah. Many of us think we're not actually terribly greedy. We're just feeling naturally attracted to goodness, or we have a sense of quality, or we just know what is precious. Yeah. So much of our greed camouflages in various other ways. It's a very encouraged quality here. Much of our society values is based around greed and acquisition. Much of our well-being, our affluence, you know, the success of our societies and our economies hinge on greed. Yeah. To challenge greed is a highly subversive activity. Yeah. It's not just psychologically counterintuitive, it is downright, you know, politically not correct. Because the motor of our industry, or industriousness, not just industry, but industriousness, is largely one of creating safety, creating affluence, creating prosperity, creating enjoyment, creating quality, creating value. Yeah. This is really at the heart of our societies. Let's be frank, this kind of Buddhist non-greed thing, this non-attachment thing, is really, it's downright off-putting, you know. It really goes to the quick to say, actually, there is a contentment that does not come out of the fridge. Yeah? There is a contentment that doesn't go by numbers. Yeah? There's a possibility for me to be satiated and complete and whole without having any number of safety fallbacks. Yeah. This is a real challenge. Yeah. So I think it makes sense that greed and metta in some way share an appreciation for this, for the quality in whatever is the focus of both our metta or our greed, but that greed wishes to appropriate, to be gratified with. Greed objectifies what is in the focus of attention. It objectifies it in terms of what can I get out of this? What does this yield to me? What is there in it for me? Yeah. Very clearly that statement. What's in it for me? Now the question is not whether we can't help being greedy. We can't help being having wishes. We can't help having desires. In fact, without such things, nothing much happens. You know, even Buddhist teachings are quite blatant. There is a passage, a rare passage, but there it is, that bluntly states that desire is to be given up by engaging desire. Yeah? And the word is tanha. This is, you know, this is the worst kind of word Buddhists have for desire. You know, thirst, you know, a quality that is intrinsically understood to be unquenchable. The more you quench it, the more it grows. You cannot get rid of thirst by trying to quench it in the ways it suggests itself to be quenched. So, you know, greed is a big, it's likely to be having some roots in your life. If you're beyond greed, you are basically an anagami. You're a non-returner. Yeah. This is fairly a lofty state of realization. It's the second last stage before complete freedom. Yeah. So don't think this is an easy thing. What we focus on in our greed, we may vary quite considerably, but we all sense this force. Some of us there's forms of greed that have more a sort of sticky quality to it. Yeah? Buddhist tradition calls this lobha, sort of the kind of suction force of it, you know. The mind latches onto something and just does not want to let go of it. Yeah? Then there is forms of greed that are more sort of kind of impulses that have urge-type qualities. Yeah? So, and we weather the urge and it somehow goes away. And then there is other forms of greed that feel more like developed passions, you know, they kind of go more at us like this. So, rah, yeah? The word raga is in the Pali for that. In the first sermon of the Buddha, the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, he speaks of two extremes. One is the extreme of seeking happiness through sense gratification. And the word used in there is not even raga, it is delight. It is the seeking out of delights. Yeah? And the wish to repeat the delight. Notice, not the delight is the problem. It is the force that wants us to keep seeking delights already experienced, or keep seeking delights fantasized or envisioned. And any honest inquiry of greed will come to the conclusion that this is the most natural thing. You know, if something feels good, why should I not repeat it? Why should I not want to go there again? Why should I not want to do it? What is the danger in this, sir? This seems the most natural thing. We all incline to things that make us feel good, that gratify our senses, that give us good feelings. Psychologically, we incline to that. Somatically, inclined to that. Yeah? And yet, it is not the enjoyment and it is not the delight, but it is the force of wish that wants to repeat this, yeah? Which is what Buddhist tradition calls grasping, attachment, latching onto, upadana, taking to us. Yeah? Remember dana, giving, offering. And adana means taking, and upadana even strengthens or reinforces the taking bit. So taking hold of it in a hard way or in a decisive way. So this is a big, big force. And although our societies are quite liberal with the culture of greed, we are taught that the freedom and the power of our capacity to consume and to obtain and to get hold of is our freedom and is our birthright. It also, it's the seal of our suffering, actually. There's a lot of suffering within greed. It's a suffering that is not as obvious as it is in, say, anger. Anger feels unpleasant. Greed doesn't feel unpleasant necessarily. You know, we all love the mild tension, the anticipation. We feel a sort of libidinous inclination towards something that is vitalizing. If you tell your psychotherapist you're not having any desires, he thinks you're depressed. You know, basic standard response. You know, no appetite, no sex drive, don't want to see anybody, don't want to go anywhere. Scratch, scratch, scratch. Yeah, sounds depressed. So there's great suspicion in if we do not define ourselves by wishes, if we do not want to engage the realization of our wishes. It is necessary for growth to realize wishes. It is necessary to have a wish to be different. At the same time, engaging greed also gets us settled. Yeah. We put on weight, we get easily disappointed, we generate unsatisfactoriness because nothing ever makes us as happy as we anticipated it would make us, or at least for any length of time. So there's a gap there between the expected happiness from obtaining what I wish and the experienced happiness from what I manage to obtain. Sometimes I don't manage. You know? There's many things that can go wrong with harboring wishes. Sometimes you just don't get what you wish for and you're disappointed. Sometimes you do get what you wish for, but it doesn't deliver. You know? Sometimes you get, it does deliver, but you don't get enough. So, you know? Sometimes you do get, it does deliver, and you get bored with it. You know? Sometimes you do get, it does deliver, and you start fretting of not getting it tomorrow. Or, you know, the Smiths down the road may get the bigger one, or, you know, something like that. So there's many things that can go wrong with trying to procure happiness by organizing the fulfillment of your wishes. You know, if these wishes are focused on objects or symbols, basically we want states. You know? Happiness is a state. The thing that we believe makes us happy is not a state, it's a thing. And we keep identifying the wished for state with a particular thing, and the thing symbolizes that state to us. But there's a great risk that the thing symbolizing does not actually produce the state or does not reliably repeat the state. But there's a lot of issues involved with greed which are not apparently obvious. Because it feels good as long as you get what you want. Greed feels a good thing. Greedy people are nice people. They're lovely. They like to share. It's warm. You like to sit there. You know, they enjoy. They want you to be enjoying. So they give you one of theirs and you enjoy with them. And it feels good. This makes friends. They're nice. It's warm. There's a gentle glow there. Angry people are not like that. They're not so inviting. It doesn't give you a warm, fuzzy feeling. So the suffering of anger is fairly easy. The suffering of rejection and distancing and defense is very easy. It's contractive. It feels lonely. You don't want to go there. They feel bad about it. Yeah. So the suffering for the pain that comes from the anger side is a lot more apparent than the suffering that comes from greed. Yeah. Just a footnote on greed. Yeah, it doesn't really belong into our weekend to say. So the near enemy of metta being greed, the far enemy of metta is ill will. It's the direct opposite. You know. When benevolence, welcoming, warm, available interest is the hallmark of metta, then the opposite of that is, you know, may you break your leg. You know. To hell with you. Be better if you were out here. You know? Things were better if this didn't happen. It's the active wish that somebody be unhappy or unwell that will not succeed in what they wish. It's you know, we engage our the force would be vyapada that. The wish, ill will, I think, is the closest I can think of in English. Yeah. Sometimes we meet people who treat us that way. What do you want? Yeah. What's the problem? Yeah. Somebody, you kind of knock on a door. Apparently he's the responsible one. And then, you know, you get ogled over and basically you get the feeling you'd be better not here in this person's books. The mere fact that you're here is already not a good sign. Yeah. You could sense the wall of ill will. Sometimes you see it in eyes, you see it in politely covered over. Step in here, Mr. Weber. Yeah. So we know we meet that many times in our lives, isn't it? We sense we're not welcome. We sense there isn't space. We sense it would prefer if this didn't take place, if I didn't take place. Yeah. Some of us get angry at this. Some of us get sorry. Here in this country, people get really sorry. Yeah. People in this country strike me as being highly skilled at being sorry. Yeah. But it's not peculiar to English, I think it's just cultivated. So sorry for my existence, for breathing your air. We all do that. Yeah. Americans laughing over here. We all do that. We all feel that if our space is not granted, yeah, something in us says, oh, yeah, do I have to make myself smaller to hope, to please and petition by being, you know, smaller, less threatening? Or do I go into my silverback mode and kind of, you know, drum on my chest and make sure I'm going to widen that space? You don't want to give me that space. I'm going to get that space. You believe me. You know, it does something to us. Some of us become rather charming and, you know, and some of us become curt and terse. And yeah, we have responses to this. And it's good to notice our response pattern is often indicative of actually what's happening. It's not indicative of our degree of skill or enlightenment or so, but often we catch a climate that we are met with by picking up on our response pattern. Yeah. That's where mindfulness is really helpful, because I may not get what's going on with you, but I do get what's going on with me. And what's going on with me may be as conditioned as is what is going on with you, but I have an anchor here. Yeah. Something feels suddenly as if the air is sucked out of the room. You know, something's happening here. And that tells me, oh, obviously I'm not getting the full picture here. This is danger. Yeah? Somebody's turning off the warm shower. Yeah. The warm shower of metta is turned off. Yeah? Or there's an unacknowledged hostility in the space. So, yeah? And we get the defense reaction in our system. So by attending to our system, we actually start having a clue what's happening over there. That's quite interesting. Obviously, engaging ill will produces the counter effect of metta. It doesn't invite in. It doesn't create availability. It doesn't give rise to trust. It doesn't give rise to connectedness on both parties, both the person exuding ill will and the person at the receiving end of ill will not be inclined to trust. I think that's fairly straightforward. It's also not very exotic. It's very likely that you have plenty of experience in both receiving and maybe handing out ill will as well. As we, you know, we're all perpetrators and victims of this, as I'm sure you're on, agree with me. Let's look at the second one, karuna, the direct enemy or the near enemy of karuna is an interesting quality. The Pali calls it Gehasita Dommanasa, which means house dweller's misery. Yeah? It means a kind of commiseration that is basically joining in the bad feeling. It's joining in the misery of something. It's like, you know, find somebody falling into a hole and you just join them. You jump in there and just share their fate with them, you know. And there's two of you down in the hole now, helpless and miserable and locked up. You know? And that is the near enemy. It obviously holds the capacity of resonance, of compassion, but it is devoid of the power to actually help. It is devoid of the strength to connect with one's own sanity and health. Yeah? And as a response to pain, it is very ineffective. It just doubles the scene, you know. The wailing gets louder, but actual help is not procured by it. I think it's fairly straightforward. Sometimes we bond that way, yeah, which is kind of, we all go moping, yeah. We join somebody moping, or complaining is a classic. Particularly complaining about somebody not present is a classic, you know. The far enemy of karuna is cruelty. Very straightforward. When compassion is the wish to alleviate somebody's pain, then cruelty is the wish to increase somebody's pain or to enjoy somebody's pain or to prolong somebody's pain. Now, obviously, we all think we're not cruel people, but I have a feeling that we're probably more cruel than many of us would like to admit. You know, there's many forms of cruelty. Well, one form of cruelty is obviously, you know, grabbing hold of people, locking them up and torturing them, which is very documented, which I expect none of you are doing. But there is gentle forms of cruelty, you know. We can give somebody the cold shoulder for a few days, or we don't respond to a pained email, or we let somebody grovel or make it up to us, or we play unavailable, or we increase somebody's fears. Yeah, we allude casually possible dangers involved in an undertaking they have just voiced they want to do, and trigger, play with their fears, or we let them hang, you know, we make them wait. We know they're kind of uneasy about waiting, and we let them wait. But there's thousands of ways we can be cruel in sort of everyday ways. Completely legal, yeah, completely legal. Nobody will ever lock you up for that. Amnesty International won't get you for it. There's many ways of just refusing to acknowledge, for example. I'm not seeing her. You know, kind of, she's not present for me. I don't acknowledge. She greets and I don't greet back. You know. Being unkind. Letting people stay in need, not respond to their needs, is a classic. You know. Or responding to their needs but making them feel that they really are a bother. You know. There's many little ways, and I think our relationships are full of these little codes and give and takes, and they're ways of, you know, being cruel. So. No smiles before 11 o'clock, sorry. Yeah, just, if you want any dealings with me, you have to put up with me, my grumpiness before 11. There's no smile. I'm not going to have any relationship with you that allows you to feel gratified that you have an impact on me. Yeah? Some people enjoy feeling independent in that way. So I suspect that we're probably more cruel than most of us would like to admit. There's many forms of cruelty. Obviously, there's deeds of commission and deeds of omission. Sometimes the latter ones are less obvious. But I think it's clear that the wish to help, the wish to alleviate, and the wish to create pain or prolong pain or intensify pain are directly opposite. Yeah. The old word for karuna, by the way, is an interesting term. It means anukampati, and that is literally translated saying that I tremble along with somebody. Yeah? It is a quality of heart that trembles along with something that takes place. The capacity, quite literally, to tremble with somebody else. I feel what he feels in such a way that I too tremble. That's what is said to be the Buddha's motivation for teaching. Because he is full of anukampa for sentient and suffering beings, he's actually bothered to coalesce his existential breakthrough into a teaching and stratify it and didactically work on it and chunk it and parse it in bits so that we can get spoon-fed with it, basically. Yeah? So that's what he does out of anukampa, out of trembling along with sentient beings. Mudita, direct enemy or the near enemy of mudita, is parallel to the householder's distraughtness we had as the near enemy of karuna. The near enemy of mudita is the wish to just join the party. It is just to have fun. I'm not interested what you're celebrating. I'm interested in the champagne you're celebrating with. Yeah. So I just, whatever the party has as a reason, don't give me the details. Just give me the booze. Yeah. I want to be where it's happening, and I just want to share the feeling. I don't want to actually share the cause of the feeling. Yeah. In other words, it's the clear seeking of pleasure and excitement and just bathe or bask in the mood, or what do you call it, free ride, or yeah. And it's I think easily seen that the actual wish to get the result sidesteps the connection with the cause. Yeah. When mudita is the capacity to sympathetically enjoy goodness that takes place for another, or success that has taken place for another. The image, by the way, the mother image, is the mother that is enjoying her child doing the first steps, or having success, or being capable of saying the first subclause in a grammatically correct sentence, or doing a college degree, or whatever. Yeah, it's the celebration when you see... you know, little Billy is capable now of speaking without splitting infinitives or so, yeah? It's the achievement part in the life of somebody else that gives us joy. Yeah? So just wanting the joy doesn't actually connect us to the reason for the joy. It doesn't actually connect us deeply. Now, this is an interesting one, because you obviously seek shared happiness. You know, much of our social life is about this. We have a few rites, you know, we share funerals and so forth, but basically we share the happy bits, you know, birth of children, marriage, parties. We're a lot better at sharing, ritually sharing joys than sharing sadness or loss. And the party spirit can get the better of us. Also, the party spirit, every culture knows that, doesn't go very deep. You know? There's a French saying that claims that les mêmes souffrances unissent mille fois que les mêmes joies. The shared suffering brings us a thousand times more close than the shared joys. You know? Which is not without depth, you know. It sounds trivial, but it is the case. I think the Thais are quite interesting. They have friends for eating, and they have friends for dying. You have pyun kin, and you have easily pyun kin. As soon as you have something to kin, generally you have lots of pyun to share in it. Yeah? So if you have food, then you generally have friends to share that food with you. It's not difficult to find friends when you have food to share. But when it comes to dying, you may have a lot less friends. And the occasion is a lot less joyous. So it is understood that the friends for eating are easily obtained. And the fact that they can join you for eating does not necessarily mean that they'll be there when you die. Which is an interesting acknowledgement of exactly the what we all know, isn't it? That if you have something to share, it's easy to have friends with. If you have hardship and if you have tough stuff to negotiate, then the friends are probably fewer. The remote enemy or the distant enemy of your capacity to joy, to anumodati, means to gladden the heart, to rejoice. The far enemy, its direct opposite, is a quality called arati. It's grumpiness, it's discontent. Do you know other words for that quality? Give me some ideas. I'm sure there are many English words for grudge. What else?
Pissed off,
definitely, yeah.
Bitter.
Yeah, could be, bitter.
envy?
No, that's too strong. But it's a kind of, it's not, it's a kind of bad tempered. It's
bad vibe.
Yeah, bad vibe, definitely. But I'm sure you have more words for this. What do you call somebody? A sourpuss?
Sourpuss,
yeah.
Mardiness.
Okay. Okay.
Old git.
Yeah, there are some rather aspiring young old gits, isn't it? Yeah.
Cultivated.
Yeah.
Cantankerous.
Yeah, is this not already a little belligerent, a little bit? But somebody who does not want to join into feeling good, who almost...
Prickliness.
Miserable is definitely one.
Irritable?
Yeah, but this is already too much...
Killjoy. Wet blanket.
Definitely, wet blanket is stare, killjoy is stare. Irascible is already too fiery.
Negative.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely, sort of, you won't get me to smile today, you know. You know, this is a nice day, but don't expect that I enjoy it, you know, kind of.
It's a Scrooge line.
Yeah, there's a holding back. Actually, that's quite good. There's something stingy about this quality. It's kind of... I'm not going to give in to a good feeling. Yeah? I prefer staying, not giving, not suffusing, not engaging. Yeah? We in German we have loads of words for that. We're really good at this. Yeah? We're really good at this. Yeah?
There's a very good French one, emmerdeur public.
Yeah, okay, we won't translate that one. We won't translate that one. It's definitely the direction. Yeah. It's somebody who does not soften, somebody who does not take in, somebody who does not want to engage, but it's just kind of hold it in, and in a sort of sourly way. Yeah. Dour, is that a word? Dour, yeah. Scottish, isn't it? So in the Buddhist mythology, Mara has kids, three daughters. Obviously the pretty ones who are called Tanha, desire. Another one is called Braga. And the third one is called Arati, discontent. So it's easy to walk in Arati's arm. Yeah, and if you walk in Arati's arm, the world doesn't look nice. The world looks as if, you know, everything is just an embarrassment. Everything is just too much. Everything is just, this can't be true. They can't be real. This can't, you know, I'm not going to go for this. Not spring again, you know, please don't bring on cherries. This kind of... If you aren't sure what it is, just kind of go 8 o'clock train stations in the morning. So this is the direct enemy of joy, of the capacity to resonate with joyous events in other people's lives. The direct enemy or the near enemy of upekkha is an interesting one. A near enemy is called indifference. It is basically the calmness about what's taking place, but the refusal of the relational resonance. You know? I'm calm with what's happening because I don't really care for you. Yeah, because it doesn't really bother me if you're going down. Yeah, because I can't be in any way, you know, bothered with what is important to you or what is actually taking place. I'm calm because I'm cut off. Indifference has many names, you know. There's traditions which praise indifference. Greek Stoics praise ataraxia, the unshakableness. In fact, Buddhists praise unshakableness. Akupa vimutti, the unshakable deliverance. But that doesn't mean, basically, I'm calm because I've written off everything to the left and to the right. It means I'm calm because I'm capable of holding my sensitivity and my connection to you, and I stay connected to my sanity, my strength, and my intactness. This is very different than just say, I don't bother, you know, or you don't matter, or I'm so thick-skinned I don't even pick up. Ignorance, Buddhist cardinal demon, yeah. In the demonology of Buddhism, the cardinal culprit is something called ignorance. And one aspect of ignorance is simply lack of sensitivity. On a sort of foundational level, ignorance manifests as lack of receptiveness and sensitivity. So one way of being indifferent is just being blunt. It's just being blunted, psychologically blunted, or attentionally blunted, perceptually blunted. I can't imagine how something is for you because I'm so preoccupied with how it is for me. I'm such an adventure to myself that I can't actually reach out to imagine what it feels like being you. So this indifference, I think, is the obvious. Again, it looks quite similar in some way to equanimity, isn't it? Sometimes it's hard to say, this is equanimity or is this indifference? The surface looks the same. It's calm. Yeah. But equanimity is connected both to self and to other. Indifference is connected at best to self, probably not even to self. Yeah, because if you're connected to your own needs, then you can't really afford being indifferent to what's happening around you. And the far enemy of upekkha, we have already met. The far enemies are the ones from metta and karuna. It's greed, or desire, and it's ill will. These two are the far enemies, the direct opposites of upekkha, of equanimity and serenity. Yeah. Greed as a sort of manifestation of tension and not getting, and ill will as the wish to harm or as the wish to push away. Buddhist psychology assumes that quite clearly that you cannot cultivate greed without at the same time cultivating aversion. That may not be obvious, but that has tremendous social psychological implications because a society that glorifies greed as individual freedom will inevitably cultivate with the culture of greed also forms of aversion and forms of disconnect. If greed is the attempt to get at the good, if you remember the baby that has all goodness coming from outside, food and affection and warmth and sheltering and getting fresh nappies and all this comes from outside, it doesn't come from inside. So if greed is the prolongation of that expectation, the good comes from outside. So if I can get the outside here to me, you know, first in my body, and then in my pocket, and then in my house, or in my trust fund, or whatever, you know, then you also cultivate an experience where this does not work. And that makes me angry. That makes me averse. That makes me hostile. So a culture of greed can only succeed for a very few people. Not everybody in a culture of greed actually gets the good bits. And the people who don't get the good bits, they do get angry. You know? They slit your car tires. They spray your graffiti. They become naysayers. Yeah? They sabotage the successful greedy one's enjoyment. Yeah? They become threatening. They start marching from the suburbs. Yeah. This is the social psychological backlash of a greed invested culture that breeds violence, it breeds rebellion, it breeds the discontent and the anger of all those who do not succeed in managing to satisfy the greed or in managing to obtain enough to feel that the principle is worth it. You know, and the end point of the development is people who are more angry then they are concerned about safeguarding their own lives. You can't protect against those people. They blow themselves up. You know? There's a very clear end point for this. If people care more to harm you than to protect their own lives, you know, our lives become pretty unsafe. So I think these enemies make a lot of sense psychologically, interpersonally, but also on a sort of social psychological level. I think it's not difficult to see the patterning there. You still have them? Metta? A close enemy is greed. Looks like metta, appreciates advantages and sees beauty and sees use, sees function, sees value, and yet wants to appropriate. Far enemy is ill will. It's the opposite of loving kindness. Yeah. I wish you bad. Die. Yeah. To hell. I remember sitting in class, I had a horrible German teacher when I was in my third grade, and the whole school class would have a mantra and say, break your leg, break your leg, break your leg. Well, we'd sit there. I don't know what you call this in English when a group of people speaks in the same rhythm.
Chanting.
That's an interesting evokes something notion. Yeah. So, but obviously we were chanting that our German teacher may break her leg on the way up to give us a test, you know. Yeah. Unfortunately, our mental powers were not very developed, and she survived the onslaught of ill will without any noticeable consequences. Yeah. Karuna, compassion, as the force that brings us in touch with the pain in somebody else's life, and combined with the wish to alleviate that pain, or to make things better. If we can't make things better, at least not make it worse. And if we can't help, we can at least comfort. And we can't even comfort, we at least don't let somebody alone. Yeah? So these are the kind of stages. Make things better? No. Not make things worse. That's the sort of minimal. Make things better. Help. Comfort. Or at least not let somebody alone when we can't help. Yeah. That's the force of trembling along with, and direct or the close enemy is just being miserable, being distraught and lost, and sharing the horror or sharing the pain without having a recourse to our own sanity, without having recourse to our intelligence, just sharing the emotional vibe, going in there and wailing along. You know? Rather than trembling along and helping, we go in and wail along. Obviously, loss of power, loss of activity, loss of intelligence, loss of resources, everything is in there. Lamentation, sharing the lamentation without sharing, actually thinking about how this could be resolved or addressed in some way. Direct, the further enemy, the direct opposite, is cruelty. It's the active wish to increase the pain or prolong the pain or intensify the pain of the other. To derive pleasure, as in sadism, or to derive power, as probably more common, to enact revenge or to threaten. I'll do a little bit of it now so that you have an idea what I do a lot of if you don't obey. To intimidate, to coerce. There's many reasons why we come to cruelty. Sometimes punishment. No. I think fairly straightforward. Also, we probably do more of that than we acknowledge.
Yeah.
We even weak people can be cruel. Yeah. It's not always a sign of somebody big and mighty and powerful who uses his or her power to exert cruelty. But sometimes weak people can be cruel. So even if you think you have no power, so you possibly can't be cruel, don't feel safe. You can still be cruel with having very little power. In fact, my experience tells me that people who feel quite helpless can still be cruel. You know? It doesn't stop. Feeling helpless doesn't protect you from being cruel. So while being greedy and occasionally being angry is something we can easily talk of, all of us would probably acknowledge that we are greedy and angry at times, being cruel is more difficult to acknowledge. Yeah? It definitely looks worse on you. It's less fun to talk about. It's closer to the bone. We have a feeling this is really not on. Cruelty. Oh, ponder that one. Next one, mudita. A close enemy is the party spirit. It's the sheer seeking of enjoyment, enticement. The scriptures speak of it as he continuously asks, where is their singing? Where is their dancing? Where is their drumming? Yeah. Where is the excitement, basically? Where? What's the in scene? Where can I go and just chime in? Yeah. Rather than connect with the reason for celebration, we just collect with the festivities in the name of the celebration. The direct opposite or the remote enemy is arati, which is malcontent, discontent, sour. What was it? I got it wrong.
Sourpuss.
Sourpuss, yeah. The unwillingness to widen the heart for states of joy, states of gladness, states of empathy, states of connection. I'm here to myself, and don't you try to elicit anything from me. This is the kind of gesture, holding it in, not giving anything away from me, not letting anything in.
Just curmudgeon.
Yeah, curmudgeon. I think curmudgeon, I think, is a pretty good one. Yeah, that's a great one. Killjoy, yeah. Yeah, yeah. We have already two votes on killjoy. Yeah. The near enemy of upeka is indifference. It's the thick-skinnedness, it's the resignation or the not taking an interest and refusing resonance with what's going on or with people around me. And because I do that, I feel happily calm, you know. I think quite a bit of that. I see that a lot in me. Just enough intensity and I go into sort of numb mode. We all numb out. I don't know how it is with you, but I find myself numbing out quite a bit. Sensory input, people, noise, too much appeals to my empathy, too much appeals to I should feel concerned, I should take an interest, I should feel responsible, and I just numb out. You know? Don't give me climate change. Don't give me migration themes. Don't give me, you know, I'm too tired. Just I want a hot bath now and I want peace. Give me a book or give me a movie or just pull the blanket. Good night, cruel. Goodbye, cruel world. You know, enough empathy for everything. Just can't get anything out of this anymore. Numbing out is quite common. And the more frequent intensity is, the more we have to negotiate wads of data and appeals, and we numb out. I think that's a fairly common experience. I don't know how it is for you, but I see that in myself a lot. Yet another little email that tells me of some horrible condition, and I read two lines and then it's the delete button. Yeah, problem is solved. You know, that's a form of numbing out. It's necessary. My time, my attention, all this is limited. It's finite. I need to make sure that there are priorities. But sometimes the priorities are not there. And sometimes the delete button comes in too early. Yeah, I'm just discomfited, or I don't want to be bothered, or I refuse to connect. Yeah? And I'm sure this is not different with you. We are doing this intensity thing in a really big way in our society. And we're so connected that we, you know, we can barely go to the loo without being somehow God. Yeah.
On that, I mean, isn't that partly, for better or worse, you know, you've got a 24/7 global media, you've got so many different ways to communicate.
Yeah, obviously we've
overload. It's a function of overload.
We've perfected the art of overload, definitely, in the last 50 years, yeah. And, you know, there is a sanity to numbing out. At the same time, it's not a virtue. You know, it's a kind of emergency, what do you call that, circuit breaker? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It does kind of emergency stuff, which saves the system, but sometimes we we let it kick in too early. It becomes not just a self-protective emergency procedure, it becomes a standard intervention technique. Yeah? I can't be bothered. And obviously, we are greatly challenged today. Our connection, communication-wise, is not replicated with practical responsibility. We have so much information input, and we can only respond to very few of those messages. Emotionally, practically. I don't know what the circumference of your area of action is, but it's probably not global. It's, you know, your family, your house, your borough, if you're lucky, your country. Or maybe topically you support a school or a nun over there, or you know, you do something about fair trade, or it's fairly topical, but for everyone you engage with and you do something good, they're going to brutalize somebody else or kill off something there. Or, you know, we all feel that we lose out. We can't do justice. I feel that constantly. I can't do justice to what I ought to do justice. And if we don't find enough upekha, if we don't find a practice that acknowledges causality and limits and boundaries and is capable of appreciating what is good despite bad things taking place at the same time, our resort is numbing out rather than staying connected. And I guess it's honest to acknowledge this. I don't have a solution. I'm just pointing to a dynamic that takes place. And when we know it takes place, we have more leeway. We have more capacity to make conscious choices rather than wait, either fall prey to our habits or wait till our system's self-defenses kicks in. Direct enemy, or the far enemy of upekkha, is again greed and ill will, as we know them from karuna and from metta. Good. I wanted to read you something very short. It's from a Tibetan great teacher. Oh, I rely on a translation that is not my own because I do not understand Tibetan. The teacher is Longchenpa, a 12th century Tibetan master. And he has, in the auto-commentary of the Great Chariot, he speaks of these four Brahma-viharas. Thus, a person who, by taking refuge, has become the site for spiritual growth, will cultivate their mind for the welfare of those who are alive by letting the flower of compassion blossom in the soil of love and tending it with the pure water of equanimity in the cool shade of joyfulness. I'll give you another translation. Beings who become the vessels of the Dharma by taking refuge cultivate their minds to the benefit of sentient beings, watered by equanimity in the cool shade of joy. Flowers of compassion will bloom in the soil of kindness. Yeah? So you have the image of water and equanimity, the soil of metta, the shade of mudita, and the flowering, the flower of compassion. It's quite beautiful, isn't it? There's a way you could speak about these four Brahmaviharas as almost as exclamations. Yeah. You could say, for the first one, you would say, metta, you would say, may all beings be well. The second one, you would say, how much pain human beings have, how much pain beings experience. For the third one, you would say, let's celebrate human beings. Yeah. And the fourth one would say something like, human beings, human beings. Yeah. Good. Let's sit for another 10 minutes, then our brief 2 days are over.